Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm Director of the Action and Research Centre here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this special event. Before we begin, can I ask you to turn your mobile phones to silent? We're filming today, and we're obviously live streaming over the web, so a very big welcome to those of you joining us online. And a reminder that the hashtag is hashtag RSAWhen, so please do join in the discussion on Twitter. Now, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome today's guest speaker, who needs very little, in fact, no introduction. Many of you will know Dan from his now-renowned RSA Animate on motivation, which has been viewed over 16 million times on the RSA Events YouTube channel. He's written 6 best-selling, award-winning books, including his newest, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, and is one of the world's foremost thinkers on business, motivation, and productivity. His latest book is less of a how-to and more of a when-to, and encapsulates and interprets the latest research on the ideal time to put every life decision into play. And it confirmed for me that I'm most definitely on a downslope, but there is an upward slope to come. And if I have a long walk and a nap, the upslope might come this afternoon, which is great news. But I'll hand over to Dan to explain more.
Okay, good afternoon. It's great to be back at RSA. I think this is, Abby, the third time I've been here. So I think that if you come 5 times, you get a free bagel or something, right? It's like a little punch card, so that's good. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this latest book that Anthony mentioned. But before that, I want to mention that I have a particular philosophy, particular dogma, really, about effective presentations. Because I have discovered over the years that good presentations in general, and any good presentation in a dark, windowless room at 1 in the afternoon in particular, always have 3 key ingredients. There are 3 key elements in any effective presentation, anywhere, anytime. You can write this on a rock. You might learn nothing else, but this you can take home with you. 3 key ingredients in any effective presentation, anywhere, anytime. They are brevity, levity, and repetition. Let me say that one more time. Brevity, levity, and repetition. So I'm going to be reasonably brief, actually really super brief, because we're going to have a lot of time for conversation. I'm not going to be too severe and serious about it all. And the final point on the repetition, I will repeat the important stuff over and 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 over again. I am a devout believer in the rhetorical power of repetition. No, I am. I'm a devout believer in the rhetorical power of repetition. So let me tell you about this book, which just came out literally a couple weeks ago. It's about timing. Okay, we make all kinds of when decisions in our life. When in the day should we do certain kinds of work? When in the day should we exercise? When should we take a break? When in our life should we quit a job, start a new career, get married? So all these kinds of questions about timing. And we tend to make those decisions in a very haphazard way, through intuition and guesswork, because we believe that timing is an art. Well, after 2 years of research, I've discovered that's not quite right, that timing is really a science, that there is this amazing, rich body of research out there across many, many disciplines, economics, social psychology, anthropology, cognitive science, endocrinology, chronobiologists, a whole array of disciplines that can give us systematic, evidence-based clues to make shrewder, smarter decisions about when to do stuff. So the key idea in the book is this right here. We believe that timing is an art, but timing is really a science. And we can use that science to make better decisions. So among the questions that I try to answer are, why should you never go into the hospital or schedule an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon? For real, seriously, don't do that. Why does I write about beginnings, middles, and ends. Why does beginning your career in a recession depress your wages 20 years later? This is actually pretty alarming evidence here. Why do both human beings and great apes experience a slump in midlife? Why are you most likely to run your first marathon at age 29? This is true. At age 29, 39, 49, or 59? 49-year-olds are 3 times as likely to run their first marathon as 50-year-olds. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds or 30-year-olds. Why is singing in a choir as good for your physical and mental health as exercise? What are some of the powers when we synchronize in time with other people? And finally, this actually pretty urgent question for some of us, when during the year is your spouse most likely to file for divorce? Turns out there are two monthly peaks in divorce filings, so pay attention. But what I want to talk about today is just one aspect of this body of research, and it's this question right here. What is the hidden pattern of the day? How does it affect our mood, and how does it affect our performance? Right? Turns out that there's some interesting research on this that yields very specific, very practical things we can do to live a little bit better and work a little bit smarter. So let's get started on that. So I'm going to give you a couple of pieces of research on mood, then a couple of pieces of research on performance, then we're going to tie it together and I'm going to give you a single takeaway. So this first piece of research comes from Cornell University. And one of the interesting things that's happening in the world of research right now is how much scholars are relying on ginormous data sets to find insights. Now, a lot of experimental social psychology, for instance, will take the paper will say, we took 71 undergraduates. We put 35 in this condition, 36 in this condition, and run an experiment, and you yield some insights. And that's legit. But there are other methodologies now that don't get us causation, but get us some fascinating correlations. And so this is one of them from Cornell. There's a program out there called the LIWC, the Linguistic Inventory Word Count. It's a piece of software that can evaluate text, all right, any kind of a text, and any not text messages, but written words. And one of the things that it can do is, at a very rudimentary level, it can measure the emotional content of words. So if you say, if the text says, I'm happy, positive, I'm sad, negative, all right? It's more nuanced and robust than that, but you get the idea. And so these researchers took 500 million tweets. Okay, that's the big in big data. Half a billion tweets, none of them from my president. 2.5 million users in 84 countries. Okay, this is the big in big data. And what they did is they threw these, remember, tweets are text, written words. So they take these massive amount of written words, throw them into this program, and the program then measures the emotional content of the words, and then they measure it across the time of the tweet. Okay? So the idea would be that we can measure people's emotions as they leak sort of through people's tweets. What does the pattern look like? They plotted it over time. Here's what it looks like. What you had is a peak, a trough, and a recovery. A peak up there in the morning, a trough. And so you notice that we are at, I appreciate RSA giving me the coveted 1 p.m. time slot. And then a recovery, a peak, a trough, a recovery. That's kind of interesting. Looks like this. Now, there are other scholars in other domains. These are sociologists. The other scholars in other domains have looked at this question as well. Let me give you one example of this. So there's one of the preeminent social scientists of our time, Daniel Kahneman, was part of a team of researchers who came up with a different methodology, something called the day reconstruction method. And for that, what he and his colleagues did was have people write down essentially each hour what they're doing and how they're feeling about it. Okay, so I'm commuting to work, I feel crappy, I'm drinking my cup of coffee, I feel good, all right? So reconstruct their day, what they're doing and their mood. And then, so he took a large sample of these people who were reporting their hour-to-hour mood based and their activity. And he and his team, too, plotted it against over time of day. And here's what they found. A peak, a trough, a recovery. Now, it's not the exact same pattern as this, but it's the same general shape. Up, down, up. And no matter the domain, when you look at people's mood over the course of a day, it follows that kind of pattern. Peak, trough, recovery. Peak, trough, recovery. No matter the discipline, no matter methodology, you see this common hidden pattern of the day. Okay, so that's our mood. And this is basically what I'm calling net, or what they're calling an emotion balance. I basically like to call it like net good mood. So you take the positive mood, you subtract the negative mood from the positive mood, so it gives you a net good mood. Okay, so that's our mood. What about performance? Well, the performance stuff is crazy. There's so much good stuff out there. But let me just give you two that I think are representative. So let's talk about, let's go back to that program, the Linguistic Inventory Word Count, which analyzes text. And let's look at the corporate world. What these researchers at New York University did is they took the transcripts of earnings calls of American public companies. Public companies have, every quarter, have earnings calls where the executives get on the call and they say, here's what we expect our earnings to, here's what our earnings were this quarter, here's what we expect them to be this quarter, et cetera, et cetera. These are things that corporate executives prepare mightily for. They're a big deal. Stock price moves up and down in response to these calls. So they took, again, I want to emphasize the big in big data. These researchers took 26,000 calls, the transcripts of 26,000 calls, 2,100 companies, 6.5 years. That's a lot of data. And what they were saying, they said, let's measure the emotional content of these calls, and let's plot it against time of day. And they said, surely it couldn't matter what the time of day is to these hard-headed, economically rational executives with a lot of money on the line. Certainly they would be immune from any of these diurnal effects. And the answer to that is, of course not. Because, I mean, why would I be mentioning it if it, right? So, but let's take a look at this, because this is actually quite, I think it's quite fascinating. Afternoon calls were more negative, irritable, and combative, leading to temporary stock mispricings for the firms hosting calls later in the day. Now, what's interesting here, and I had a battle with my editor about this, this is true even if you control for fundamentals, right? So if you're reporting earnings that are terrible, you're going to be irritable. If you had a bunch of factories that burned down, you're going to be irritable. But even if you control for the fundamentals of what they're reporting, and this is, we had basically a three-month battle about whether I was going to be able to italicize even controlling for the fundamentals. And I lost. But even, I'm gonna italicize it here verbally, even controlling for the fundamentals. Negative afternoon calls were more negative and irritable, and it had a temporary effect on the stock. So there's actually an arbitrage opportunity here for someone who, I mean it very seriously, I bet someone could figure this out, that there's a mispricing here and someone could take advantage of it. And so these researchers who, most scholars don't like to offer prescriptive advice. They offer prescriptive advice here. An important takeaway from our study for corporate executives is that communications with investors and probably other critical managerial decisions and negotiations should be conducted earlier in the day. Okay, one more example on performance. Let's go to Denmark. Let's go to Denmark, and let's talk about standardized tests in Denmark. Standardized tests in Denmark. And if you're wondering, if you put standardized tests, comma, Denmark into Google Images, this is the picture you get. So standardized tests in Denmark. Here is something, again, big data, but this is something. What happened in Denmark is the kind of thing that makes scientists weep with joy about the mystery of the universe. Here's what happens in Denmark. In Denmark, students take standardized tests. They don't take them on pencil and paper, sort of forms that they fill in with pencils. Instead, they take them on computers. But the typical Danish school has more students than computers. So not everybody can take the test at the same time. Okay, here's where the weeping begins. So students are randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. So it's a natural experiment, and these researchers, led by Francesca Gino at Harvard, looked at 2 million Danish standardized test scores. And what they found was the following. For every hour later in the day, scores decrease. We find that an hour later in the day causes a deterioration in test score that is equivalent to slightly lower household income, less parental education, and missing 2 weeks of school. Student takes a test in the morning. This student takes a test in the afternoon. This student here is performing as if she had missed 2 weeks of school. That's alarming. If we're making decisions about education policy based on standardized tests, if we're making decisions about this kid based on standardized tests, we didn't take into account time of day. Let me give you a couple of other things here. I didn't put this in, but I want to mention it. Let's talk about healthcare. I put up that question about going to the hospital or going to an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon. Don't. All right? Don't, please. If you care about your own health or the health of people you love. Anesthesia errors. 4 times more likely at procedures that begin at 3 p.m. versus procedures that begin at 9 a.m. All right? It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm visiting another country, so that obviously, as a diplomatic gesture, let's talk about colonoscopies. All right? Colonoscopies. Colonoscopies. You have endoscopists find half as many polyps in colonoscopies in afternoon exams versus morning exams. Hand washing in hospitals. This is all U.S. data, but it's big. It's some really great research. I don't have the chart. I love charts. I got a bunch of charts here. But I'll draw the chart for you about hand washing in hospitals over time. Okay, the vertical axis is how often a nurse or a physician will wash his or her hands given an opportunity. The horizontal axis is time of day. Here's what hand washing in hospitals. Here's a chart of hand washing in hospitals. Okay. Incredible drop-off in hand-washing in hospitals in the afternoon. So there's a parade. So these time-of-day effects, and we're just talking about timing effects in a day. We're not talking about in a year, in a project, in any kind of enterprise. We're just talking about in a day have massive effects. Time-of-day effects can explain, according to the research, about 20% of the variance in human performance on cognitive workplace tasks. Okay, so we like to say that timing is everything. This doesn't indicate that timing is everything, but it indicates it's a big thing. It's a big thing. And one of the problems we have is, and I'll get to this at the end, because I think it's one of the key points in all of this research, is that when we operate as individuals, organizations, even at an institutional policy level, we're very intentional about certain kinds of things. For instance, let me ask this question. Anybody here today have a to-do list? Raise your hand if you have a to-do. So almost everybody, okay? We're very intentional about what we do. We're pretty intentional about how we do it. So corporations have education and training and development departments. We're pretty intentional about who we do it with. We don't let anybody into our organization. We have job interviews. We have an HR department. Okay? We're intentional about what we do, how we do it, who we do it with. But when it comes to when we do things, we don't really think about it that much. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. And my point is, it matters. It's a material question. It matters significantly. I'm not saying it's more important than what we do or how we do it or who we do it with, but it's just as important. So the good news here is that this research yields some very specific, practical things that we can do to get better. There is a way to understand your own pattern, match it to the pattern of the day, and figure out how to do the right task at the right time. So I'm going to show you how to do that. It's relatively simple. Now, these are broad design principles. I'm not going to say, oh, everybody should begin doing this at 7:07 a.m. It doesn't work that way. There's going to be some individual variation, but there's big individual variation on one thing, which is called chronotype. A word you probably have heard before. This is essentially our propensity. Do we wake up early and fall asleep early, or do we wake up late and fall asleep late? Are you a lark? There's an ornithological metaphor here. Are you a lark, or are you an owl? And if you are a lark, and what the research shows is that about 15% of us are very strong morning people. About 20% of us are very strong evening people. Most of us are in between. What I call those folks third birds. Believe me, I went through about 1,000 bird names to find something better than that. Nothing's better than third birds. And so the first step here is to figure out what your chronotype is. Now, there are various chronotypes assessments. There's the Munich Chronotype Questionnaire. There's a Horn-Osberg instrument. There's also a very simple back-of-the-envelope way to figure out what your chronotype is. Are you a lark, an owl, or a third bird? And we can do it right here literally in a minute. And this will be the first step. What you're looking for is you want to figure out what's your type, what's your task, and then match it to the time of day. So for your type, what I want you to figure out your chronotype, this back of the envelope way, is I want you to think about what chronobiologists call a free day. A free day is a day you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. You don't have to get up at a certain time. You're free to go to sleep anytime you want. So on a free day, what time do you usually go to sleep? So I'll use me as an example of this. We'll do the calculation here. It's Pretty simple. So on a free day, I don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. I'll go to sleep about midnight. Now, second question, what time do you typically wake up on that free day? All right, I will typically wake up, if I don't have to wake up to an alarm clock, at 8 a.m. Okay? Then, then you have to use that, and you do this incredibly sophisticated calculation. You can use Excel for this. What's the midpoint of sleep? So the midpoint of sleep, if you go to sleep at midnight and wake up at 8, would be 4. Everybody wants to answer that question. 4, all right? And then there's you can look at this distribution, a chart that has a distribution, but an easier way to do it is, if your midpoint of sleep is before 3:30, you're probably a lark. If it's after 5:30, you're probably an owl. And if you're anything else, you're probably in the middle. So I'm kind of in the middle. I'm a sort of larky, but not a full-fledged lark. And what this shows is the following. What this means is the following, that roughly 4 in 5 of us move through the day, and this is why you have when you ask everybody why you have this pattern, 4 in 5 of us move through the day in that pattern that I described. Peak, trough, recovery. Peak, trough, recovery. Now, if you're an owl, and I said about 20% of us are owls, and owls are absolutely discriminated against in the work world. The work world is completely biased against owls. You move through it in the other direction, recovery, trough, peak. And what the research shows is that if you know your chronotype, if you know which direction you're moving, are you peak, trough, recovery, or recovery, trough, peak, you can begin to do the right work at the right time. So let me just show you. This is a super simple chart. Feel free to take a photograph of it, share it, however, because it's like this is gonna help. This helped me considerably. I think it's gonna help you. So let's take the stage. So let's take peak. All right. What kind of task should we be doing during our peak, whether it's at the beginning or whether it's at the very end? And I'm gonna spare you the research on this and go straight to the punchline. What the research shows is that we should be doing analytic tasks. By analytic tasks, I mean this. Tasks that require heads down, focus, and the key word here comes up in all the papers, vigilance. Tasks that require heads down, focus, and vigilance. Writing something, writing a report, analyzing financial statement. That kind of the thing that requires, okay, I can't be distracted, I want to bat it away, I want to be locked down and focus. That kind of work we do better during the peak. The trough. What should we do during the trough? If you haven't gotten the point, stay out of the hospital. Number two. Do your administrative work then. That's a good period for almost none of us. So move your administrative stuff to the extent you can, to the extent your boss will be enlightened and she'll let you do these kinds of things. Answer your routine email. Fill out your expense reports, that kind of routine stuff. And one of the mistakes that people make is that they take the peak period and they start messing around on email, squandering that time, or worse, their boss makes them go to meetings all morning, and so they can't actually do their real work, and when it's time to do their real work, they're in this terrible period right here. Final stage, this is interesting, the recovery. The recovery is a very interesting time of day for us, because what we have is, if you remember from the chart, we have elevated mood, our mood goes back up, and we're less vigilant than during the peak. We're less vigilant. But the combination of elevated mood and less vigilance is actually helpful for creative kinds of work. Think about brainstorming. In brainstorming, you want to be in a decent mood, but you don't want to be the kind of person who, in brainstorming sessions, that's a stupid idea, that's a stupid idea. Remember, in the peak, you're batting away distractions. In the recovery, you're less vigilant. Okay, maybe we should, you know, have a camel at our next offsite meeting or something like that. That's not a bad idea. I have no idea where that came from. So during your recovery, you're better off doing what are called insight tasks, tasks that require conceptual thinking, creativity. And, I mean, I don't want to say it's that simple, but it is. You're going to have to, as individuals and as bosses, you're going to have to figure out, okay, what exactly is the time, the precise time for that. But as a general design principle, this is what you should be doing. This is how offices should be operating. And I really put a lot of the onus on bosses. Because bosses, again, they're not intentional about when. They're intentional about what you do. They're intentional about how you do it. They're watching you. They're intentional about who you do it with. They put you on certain teams. But when it comes to the when, they're not intentional at all. So in the main thing here, again, just to repeat that big idea is this, that these questions of when matter. They have a material effect on our well-being. They have a material effect on our health. They have a material effect on our education. And so we need to start taking them seriously and be as intentional about these questions as we are about other things. So welcome Anthony back up to the stage here, and we'll take some questions. Applaud for Anthony.
Thank you. I could feel the calendar entries moving around in my pocket as you were talking, which is useful. Let's resist the temptation to start off with your president and what his tweeting says about his cognitive capabilities.
Yes.
But I think probably suffice to say there are owls, there are larks, there are third birds, and then there's Donald Trump.
Right.
Let's just leave that there
right.
and park it.
Right.
But what I'm interested in is going into the biology that underpins
yeah.
some of this. And you know, we structure our working lives around a certain structure. We have lunch at a certain time, we have the end of the day at a certain time, and some of the mood changes could be interpreted as sort of anticipating those particular events
sure.
as opposed to responding to our body clocks. How much in your book picks up on the possibility that it's the way we structure our lives that's driving some of this rather than the underpinning biology?
It certainly plays a role in it. In the Kahneman research on the day reconstruction method, what they noticed was they also matched it to activity. And so the activity that people... If you can guess, what activity in the course of a day did people like the least? Sort of the lowest well-being, lowest mood, and was during what activity in the day? Take a guess.
Commuting,
right, exactly. And so it's arguable that, you know, that... So it plays a role. However, if you look at other patterns, purely physiological patterns, things like body temperature,
yeah.
Things like wakefulness, that have nothing to do with the structure... you see that pattern. And arguably, this trough, this is something you can't prove, but that trough could be an evolutionary adaptation
yeah.
rather than anything that is constructed by our society. So for instance, remember, you know, our brains are, we have brains that evolved the African savanna
yeah.
where there weren't mobile phones or anything like that. And arguably, you can say that trough, when the sun was at its highest, when it was the most blisteringly hot, that was actually a good time to retreat, to go underneath a tree, to get out of the sun. And so it could be that people who were actually had their peak during that midday period died, and therefore didn't pass their genes to the next generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people who did say, oh man, it's really kind of hot out here, I'm going to go take a nap under the tree, actually lived and passed their genes into the next generation. So you're right that there's an overlay of society and culture, but there's a very, very, very strong biological underpinning.
Interesting. And you mentioned there sort of our interface with technology. And,
yeah.
and how much in the course of your research were you picking up on the degree to which technology might be starting to disrupt some of this because of the way we're interacting with our smartphones
oh,
and when
yeah.
we're doing it and how we're doing it and so on?
Yeah. I mean, this book more than any book that I've written changed how I do a lot of things.
Yeah.
So for instance, in the course of doing it, I actually just doubled down on my own work schedule.
Yeah.
So I wrote probably 90% of the words in this book before noon.
Okay.
Because I cabined myself in my office, turned off my mobile phone, and said, you're going to have to write a certain number of words every day. But the big thing here, Anthony, is some of the research on breaks.
Yes.
The research on breaks is really quite remarkable.
Yeah.
What it shows is that we should be taking more breaks and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. I think that the research on breaks is where the research on sleep was maybe 15 years ago. So 15 years ago, I mean, you remember the sort of the workplace. I'm 10 years older than you, so you might you remember 15 years ago.
Even my declining brain. It's
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I have no recollection. I've just heard stories of what happened
yeah,
15
indeed.
Years ago. No. So 15 years ago, in certain kinds of workplace cultures, it might be a more of American phenomenon. There were people who would come into the office and say, "I only got 2 hours of sleep last night. I pulled an all-nighter. I haven't slept more than 3 hours for 6 weeks." And those people were seen as somewhat heroic. And I always felt bad encountering those kinds of people. I always felt, okay, I'm kind of frail, feckless, not fully committed. And now what happened is the science of sleep emerged, and we realized, oh, that guy's not a hero. It was always a guy. That guy's not a hero. He's an idiot.
Yes.
He's hurting his own performance. He's hurting our performance. And I think that breaks are where sleep, and the reason for that was that we understood more about sleep. And I think breaks are where sleep was 15 years ago. So we should take more breaks and certain kinds of breaks. But to circle back to an actual answer to your question, the one of the things that the research shows about the kinds of breaks that we should be taking, and there's some very good research, a lot of it out of South Korea in the last 2 years, full detachment during our breaks.
Yeah.
You can arrest a lot of the downdraft. You can arrest this dip through breaks. So for instance, the hand washing in hospitals, a remedy, give nurses more breaks and certain kinds of breaks, especially social breaks. Social breaks, breaks with other people, are more restorative. The Danish research, the remedy, give kids a 20 to 30 minute break to run around before they take the test, their scores go back up.
Yeah.
And so, but one of the elements of the right kinds of breaks to take are fully detached.
Yeah.
And so you gotta leave your phone behind. And so our inability to detach is very, very dangerous. And it's one of the things that we have to be, like the other things, have to be intentional about.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, interesting. And one of the things you cover in the book, I mean, obviously we're in the time of the year of resolutions and detoxes and, you know, particular vegan Thursdays and so on, which are all very, very, very useful devices. But I guess the question I had, and it's some of the how-to in this, how do you sort of get a degree of authenticity around these personal commitments that you make? I mean, of course, obviously the enthusiasm tails off relatively quickly.
Yeah.
You see people in new gym kit in the gyms in January, and they disappear by early February. But how do you develop that sense of habit-forming authenticity around the sort of resets that you talk about, that you advocate?
It's interesting that you use the word authenticity, because I don't really write about that. I think that some of the things that we do to perform better are essentially ways to trick ourselves.
Yes.
So, I mean, it could be that the authentic expression of ourselves is that we're just lazy as hell and don't really want to do much.
Yes.
That could be our authentic state. I'm not sure it's our ideal state. You know, but it's an interesting, I think that's actually a fascinating question.
Yeah.
What you're talking about in particular is something, and it's quite interesting because it's less authentic and more of a trick, I think,
is
something called temporal landmarks. There's some really, really great research on this. Certain days of the year operate as landmarks in the way that physical things operate as landmarks in space. So what these temporal landmarks do, like physical landmarks, is they get us to slow down, but they also trigger this really peculiar form of mental accounting. So, and you see this with New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
So what we'll do is, just like a business will open up a fresh ledger at the beginning of a quarter or the beginning of a year, we will do that mentally. We'll say, oh, well, old me never went to the gym, but new me, wearing this glorious new gym kit, is gonna exercise more. And the truth of the matter is that you actually have a better chance of adhering to the behavior if you use these temporal landmarks. And so this is why you're better, if you're gonna do this, if you're gonna try to some kind of behavior change, it's not foolproof, but we're talking in probabilistic terms. You can up your probability if you start it on a Monday rather than on a Thursday, if you start it on the first of the month rather than on the 13th of the month, if you start it on the day after your birthday rather than the day before your birthday. And so I love the idea of, like, is that authentic? It might not be.
Yes.
But, you know, I'd rather have people, you know, lose some weight and be healthier, even if it requires that sort of mental trickery.
Yeah, and giving it a go. But I guess the authenticity is whether you can carry it on,
whether
the trick lasts.
Yeah, and so that's going to be, there's a lot of research on habit formation, and basically what it shows is do one thing, don't try to do everything. So don't try to start the habit of going to the gym and eating a plant-based diet and calling your mother regularly and, you know,
some of those more difficult than others.
Vacuuming the floor every 2 days. Just pick one thing, and then there's some interesting research on, you know, look for a particular trigger to set it in place, and put it in your calendar. Find someone else to hold you accountable. Those kinds of things.
So there is, going to the sort of wider perspective of all this, and the wider ramifications, it seems to me, reading you, there is a sociology of time and politics and economics, and seamlessly onto a report that we've published today on the modern workforce. It's quite clear, and you say that actually in your work it's important you have autonomy and challenge. It's very clear to us that at least a third of the working population in the UK do not have autonomy and probably have very little challenge as well.
Yeah.
And then so what is the agenda that flows from this that is beyond the individual to think about how we organise our work to ensure that, I mean, nurses is a case in point in terms of, you know, the hygiene, the hospital, making good decisions and so on. We have to factor this into our organisation of modern life somehow.
Absolutely. And I mean, the research that you've done, I mean, there's a just consistent body of research showing, if you think about it as a, about work in general as a, sort of like a writer trapped in a management consultant's body, but if you think about it as a 2x2 matrix, what you want is exactly as you're saying, is you want, the ideal is to have work that is under your control and demanding. So if you have just one of those, so let's say you have something that's demanding and not in your control, you burn out, all right? Let's say you have something that's in your control, but it's not demanding, you're bored, you're disengaged. Let's say you have something that's neither in your control nor demanding, that's just a drift.
Yeah.
And so the sweet spot is really something that is demanding and in your control. And I just think that bosses, institutions aren't, I keep using this word, intentional enough about that. And I think they need to be. And I think that the people who organize the architecture of the workplace, not the physical architecture, but sort of the temporal architecture, the substantive architecture, need to take that into account. What's interesting is that there's some, just like sort of, people will do workarounds, though.
Yes.
Individuals will do workarounds. So there's a line of research by Amy Wisniewski at Yale called job crafting. And what you'll find is that people will take these jobs that are either not in their control or not that demanding and actually recraft them in some ways to make them that way without the you know, the blessing of their boss.
Yes.
So in the same way we do, like, oh, let's say you're using a computer program and it's a little dodgy. Oh, I got a workaround. Yes. That people will do workarounds around that, which suggests something innate, that we want a sense of challenge. We want a sense of sovereignty over what we do.
It's so interesting, isn't it? And of course, this afflicts not just those who are at the sharp end of the labour market. It afflicts some of those at what we interpret as the top end. People in very powerful, very responsible positions that don't actually have autonomy when it comes down to it. You know, political leaders ultimately do not have autonomy. They are in a situation of extreme stress where they are responsible for making decisions that affect millions of lives, our collective well-being, and so on. And when you apply the lens of time to that, it's even more concerning, isn't it?
Let's go to those corporate executives. I mean, I think, you know, you can take a step back and say, oh, don't do your earnings calls in the afternoon. But then I think you can take another step back and say, why are we doing quarterly earnings calls?
Yeah.
Am I the best steward of this for-profit company if I'm myopic in that way of only, in that temporal way of only looking at the next quarter, only looking at the next quarter, only looking at the next quarter?
Yes.
Leaders who are only looking at the next quarter are less likely to say, oh yes, what we really need to do is a concerted effort throughout our organization to create jobs that are both demanding and in control. They're saying, oh nope, 90 days.
It's interesting. And you know, you could see the sort of technologies that are facing us as correcting some of these biases currently. But on that analysis, all that is yet another structure we impose externally. I mean, it may enable consultants to diagnose cancers more readily, and that might smooth out some of the vicissitudes in terms of the time.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's not going to correct it because they are still going to have responsible decisions to make, and it can't overcome that.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the, and RSA has done a lot of work on this. I think one of the big, the looming challenges right now is what are we going to do for a living in a world of automation? How are we going to structure it? And I think there's almost a philosophical question of, in that world, what is work for?
Yeah.
And that's a deeper question that is, I think all three of those questions are being largely ignored.
Great.
Except in this building.
Of course. It's what we spend our time doing,
yeah.
But not early afternoon. So let's get some questions from the audience. I'm going to take a range of questions. If you can put your hands up. I'm going to go with this gentleman here, that lady there, and this gentleman here. So we've got three from this side of the room, and I'm going to fan across the room slowly, perhaps.
Yeah, hi. Great talk. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I have a son who's about to take his end of school exams, and inevitably some of those will be in the afternoon. What advice would you give him if he was here to avoid that 20% performance drop?
For taking the test in the afternoon? Well,
you can't change the time.
Okay, so we're going to stipulate that you can't change the test? Okay, so this. How old is your son?
16.
Okay, what time of day is the test?
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock? Ooh. I would suggest that immediately before the test, he take a good break. All right, and here are the elements of a legitimate restorative break. Number one, I think in this case, usually something is better than nothing, but I would advise like 20 minutes. All right. Number two, I feel like I'm practicing medicine without a license,
yeah,
but whatever.
Go for it. Go for it.
Whatever.
It's not being broadcast, so it's fine.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's not a gigantic violation of several diplomatic treaties between our two countries, too.
That's okay nowadays.
It's fine. I'm laughing because I'm in pain.
Yes.
Okay. I would take a what we know about breaks. Social beats solo. So I would take a break with a friend. All right. Don't take a break and ruminate about the test. Take a break. I mean that very seriously. That social breaks are more restorative than solo breaks. And this is one of the things. It's true even for introverts. This is one of the things that come out in the research on those nurses and the hand washing. Second, move. So take a break. Don't just sit there. Take a break. Move. Third, there's amazing research on the restorative effects of nature. Simply being outside, seeing trees, and as we were talking about before, fully detached. So if we take those design elements, what I would suggest is go out for a 20-minute walk with a friend before the test. Go outside, walk around for 20 minutes with your friend. Don't bring your phone with you, and don't talk about the exam. And I think what you're gonna have is a restoration of attention and a boost in mood.
Great, thank you. And it was this.
So I was going to ask, what could companies? Most companies are international now. So how do they deal with this time slump during the day when everyone's on a different scale?
That is an incredibly difficult question, and no one has really resolved it. I mean, I think that the way that they're resolving it, not even resolving it, the way they're just working around it right now is essentially through handoffs. So you take something in this time zone and hand it off to somebody in that time zone. I think it's an extremely hard problem to solve I think that there could be a solution in doing things asynchronously. So instead of having a conference call, you have an email chain of some kind or some other kind of asynchronous mechanism. So you don't, because I've been on conference calls and things like that where it's 11 o'clock at night where I am, and it's, you know, it's a different time of day in Australia. I don't even know what it would be in Australia then, but or China or something like that. And it's like, okay, at 11 o'clock at night, I am just not at my best in anything. Yeah. And I think that it would be better off figuring out, is there a way for us to do this asynchronously so each party can be matched at a more ideal time?
It's this gentleman here.
Hello, Jeremy Kaplan, fellow of the RSA. Taking that model a bit further, isn't the paradigm, the challenge that we face is continuous working model? So what about split shifts, where you literally say to people, I want you to work 8 or 12 in the morning, then go off and take a walk in the woods, do whatever you want to do, pick up your kids from school, and then come back again, switch on again at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and do 4 more hours. Wouldn't that build into the model for companies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you look at, we have some, there's a fascinating book called Daily Rituals, edited by a guy named Mason Curie. And what he did is he went to diary entries and biographies of inventors and artists, visual artists and novelists, and looked at their diary entries and essentially consolidated them as a lovely book of like, oh, how did Voltaire, you know, organize his day? And we went through it for my book. I had one of the people helping me out on some of the research go through and actually read each one and analyze it to see what the pattern was. And we had about, I think it was around 60% of artists who had some sovereignty over what they were doing had that exact model. They would be heads down in the morning doing their stuff. They would take that break in the afternoon, and then they would return to it later in the afternoon. And you see, that's our analysis of this one piece of data. You also see some interesting work. Anders Ericsson, who is the Florida State social psychologist, who gave us the notion of deliberate practice, which is probably a phrase that you know. It's a certain way of practicing. He looked at violinists, elite violinists, and elite violinists had that pattern. They would practice like crazy in the morning. They would take off the afternoon and then go back again later in the day. And so I think that when people have sovereignty over what they do, that can be a very fulfilling pattern if they're that kind of chronotype. I think the challenge is that not everybody has that kind of freedom. And I think when you don't have that kind of freedom, you have to begin a conversation with bosses, because I really put the onus on them, as I said before, and you have to look for ways to work the margins. But if one has control over one's schedule, that's essentially my schedule, and I have sovereignty over my schedule.
Great. There's a lady right at the back there. And please indicate if you want to be called after this.
Elizabeth Baru, fellow of the RSA. The perfect timing, I was wondering if you had anything to say about lateness.
Lateness? In what respect?
Well, it seems to me there are some people who are always running after time, and I place myself in that category.
And yet here you are. Is that why you're in the back?
Yeah.
That's. I actually don't know so much of the research on that. One of the things that does come out, and there's a. Oh my gosh! Can I have the book for a second? There's a terrific book by Robert Levine, and for some reason I just have a complete mind freeze about what the title of the book is. Bear with me here for a sec. A Geography of Time. And what it shows is that you probably know this. Different cultures have different approaches to time. So some of them have basically like clock time culture, U.S., U.K., Germany even more, and then you have something like a more of a social time, and so when do you want to have the meeting? Oh, in the afternoon. In some cultures, in other cultures, it'd be at 2 o'clock. So I think there's a big cultural imprint on that in terms of like individual variation on that. I don't know very much. It could be that people who are chronically late are just overcommitted and overscheduled. It could be that they are low on conscientiousness. I'm not sure. I seriously don't know. It's not a value judgment. It's just purely analytical. Yeah.
God, all the questions are good. I'm going to start taking it in banks of three. So I'm going to take this lady here, this gentleman here. I'm going to take a question off or two off Twitter.
Oh, good. We have Twitter questions.
Yeah.
Tremaine Dupri's fellow. Jet lag, when your body's 8 hours behind you and you don't have the opportunity to take restorative breaks and you pretty much don't know anyone socially. Right. Any tips?
So,
should we take them in three or do you want to do them?
Well, you know what? Since I just got off a plane, I might not be able to keep in my head.
Go for it.
Jet lag. The best thing you can do on that. There's another interesting book by a guy named Till Ronenberg, who's probably the preeminent chronobiologist, writes a little bit of, it's called Internal Time, a very interesting book about this whole topic. With that, we were not built for jet lag. So if you want to try to adapt, the best thing to do is, I mean, first of all, one of the key things here is to be much more, in general, is to be much more observant of our own patterns of behavior. All right? And so to really say, okay, how do I feel right now? And actually chronicle it to see what your responses are to jet lag. What I find helpful is, and I think there's some good research on this, is as quickly as you can, adjust to the time, your destination time. So what I try to do if on long flights or long travel across time zone is that from the moment I get on the airplane, I will pretend that I am on the time zone of the place that I am going to. So if it's dinner time where I'm going, I'll eat dinner. If it's sleeping time, I'll sleep. And that can be a way to sort of force yourself to do that. Also, when you're in, like for me, what's going to be helpful, I mean, I literally got off a plane like 4 or 5 hours ago. And so what's helpful for me in these kinds of situations is natural sunlight during the day and going to sleep at the time that you're supposed to go to sleep. And those could be hard. But, you know, we talk about our evolutionary brains, like, you know, there weren't even time zones when our brains evolved, let alone moving across 8 time zones.
Well, given it's first thing in the morning for you, we're going to continue with the questions. This one.
Hi, Glenn Elliott, fellow too. I'm halfway through the book, and I kind of halfway through, I kind of think there's such a body of evidence that we're not consistent through the day. It's kind of almost like a manifesto for flexible working. Like, it's kind of, I can't think of a better set of body of evidence for flexible working that I've seen. And I wondered if you've met any companies that are really taking it seriously yet.
Not yet. I mean, I think that there are companies that are doing a better job of it. I mean, I think there's a great deal of, I think there are certain kinds of companies, generally companies that are not legacy companies that have been founded in the last 10 or 15 years, that have more innately a sense of, or as we were talking before, a sense of autonomy and saying, okay, we're going to let people work at the right times. You have some companies that are doing things like putting in nap pods. So in the U.S., Zappos is doing that, Uber is doing that, Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream maker, is doing that, sort of the groovy hippie companies are doing that. But a lot of groovy hippie things start here and then migrate to the mainstream. And so I think there's a slow recognition of that. And yet, these questions of timing, these when questions, still remain second or third order questions. And so I'm hoping that I might be naive, but I like to believe that over time, people are persuaded by evidence.
Great. Let's take a Twitter question or two.
Yes, Mr. President.
So we've got a...
Do the accent.
We've got a question from Natalie Spencer, who asks, what advice do you have for night owls who are trapped living in a corporate lock?
Oh, good question, yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, it's really hard. I have a lot more... I'm not a night owl, but I have, having read this, I have a lot more empathy for night owls. It's almost like when I remember being a little kid growing up in America in the 1970s, and what it was like to be, I'm not left-handed, but what it was like to be left-handed. And it's like, you were totally screwed if you were left-handed. You know, it's like, the desk is over here. So you have to write around like that if you're left-handed. Oh, sorry, we don't have scissors for you. And so all the, you know, the left-handers were like completely discriminated against. So for advice on this, for the night owls, let's take an example here. Let's say you're a night owl. How many people here are night owls, would you say? Okay, so if you're a night owl, let's say you're a night owl and you have to be at an important analytic meeting at 8 in the morning. Okay, horrible, terrible, disaster. But let's say that it's unavoidable. What do you do? I think you have to take some precautionary measures. And I think what you can do are the following. Number one, during that day before, when you're in your better period, when you're rocking and rolling at 9 o'clock at night, what I would do is I would think about that meeting and what do you have to accomplish at the meeting? What do you have to say? And write a mini checklist in the way that a surgeon would for surgery. Okay, so literally, in your peak, write down that checklist so you don't have to draw on your hazy brain at that moment. Number two, as I keep saying, breaks, 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 breaks. Go out for a walk around the block before you go into the meeting. That's going to be restorative. The second is there are other ways to boost our mood, and one of the really powerful ways to boost our mood is to do something good for somebody else. So doing something good ends up being this enormously selfish act in many ways. So make your checklist the night before, take a walk around the block before you go into the meeting, and then maybe that morning before you go in, like, buy somebody a cup of coffee or do something like that. That good deed will boost your mood. But it's hard to do, and I think you have to really take those kinds of precautions.
Two more questions. This lady here, and then this lady back here.
Hi, I'm Trisha Taylor. I'm a fellow. And I wanted to ask you if you know anything about napping, the value of napping, and how long is the ideal nap? And then to kind of follow on to that, because I think that I like to wake up early in the morning, and I like to go to bed late at night, but I love a nap around 3:30. So, have you seen any research around that?
I have spent an enormous amount of time looking at the napping research. It made me very sleepy. No, I have. This is one of those areas, as Anthony and I were talking about before, where I actually changed my ways. So in the past, I have napped. And I hated it. I woke up feeling terrible, both not only groggy, but also ashamed of myself. I mean it. It's like a, sort of like a moral offense. And what I realized, and it goes directly to your first part of your question, I was doing it wrong. There's a lot of great research on napping. And what it shows is that the ideal napping time is shorter than we think, 10 to 20 minutes. It seems like that couldn't be right. Okay, good. All right. So 10 to 20 minutes is the ideal nap time. If you nap longer than that, you begin to accumulate what's called sleep inertia, which is basically that groggy, boggy feeling we have. And so what happens is you have a decline in your alertness and performance that you have to dig out of before you get the restorative benefit. So there's the ideal napping time of 10 to 20 minutes. In fact, I mean, Anna can attest for this, and so did Abby. In the green room, I basically took a 10-minute nap before I came out here. Maybe that's an argument against a 10-minute nap after seeing you here, but anyway. There is an ideal nap out there, and it's weird. I'll describe it to you. It's weird. I'm going to say that at the outset. It's weird. Here's what you should do. All right? And I do this. One. I don't have my phone on me because I could verify that. Okay, so one. Have a cup of coffee. Stick with me here. Okay? Have a cup of coffee. What I do is this. One, have a cup of coffee. Two, I set my phone alarm, my phone timer, countdown timer, for 23 minutes. Okay? You can do it for whatever you want, but I do it for 23 minutes. Then I sit back in a chair. I usually have my headphones on, and sometimes if it's really bright, I put on an eye mask. And I lie back and try to sleep. You get better at napping, like most things in life, you get better at napping if you do it more. I think napping is actually akin to meditation. When people first try to meditate, their mind is racing all over the place, and then over time, I got it back, and they get better at it. So napping is the same thing. So let's say I can fall asleep in 6 or 7 minutes. That would give me 16, 17 minutes of a nap, right in that sweet spot. But here's where it gets. So my timer goes off at 23 minutes. I wake up, but remember the cup of coffee. It takes about 25 minutes for caffeine to get into our bloodstream. So what you're doing is you get the ideal nap. This is for real, all right? You get the ideal nap, and as you're waking up, boom, you get that extra hit of caffeine. And this is actually fairly widely practiced by people and verified by a lot of good evidence. It's something known as the nappuccino.
I know there are other questions, but I'm actually going to finish there because it's such a good moment to finish on. And we're going to go for our nappuccinos now. But before that, hopefully you'll pick up a copy of When by Dan Pink. It ties together the evidence, research, storytelling, the how-to, the when-to beautifully. Thank you very much for
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.